Hello and welcome to This Week I Learned, your audio guide to the most surprising discoveries and fascinating studies of the week. I'm your host, Lauren Hansen. This week, I learned that crows make up after fights. Crows do not have the fuzziest of reputations. Sure, they're highly intelligent and very loyal creatures, but they're also loud, rambunctious, and have the unfortunate habit of being associated with death, both because of their black feathers and because they are scavengers who will gamefully pick over a carcass. But it turns out a murder of crows has a softer side. So crows are known to form long-lasting social relationships with other crows. And a new study out of Germany wanted to get to the bottom of how these new relationships form. So researchers started out with crows that were total strangers to each other. In the study, the crows were first kept in a cage. When researchers first put food into the cage, they noticed the birds fought more when the food was scarce than when there was plenty of it, which totally makes sense. What was interesting was what happened after these squabbles. If the fight was only mildly aggressive, the agitator would, when the food was gone, seek out its victim. And it would sit close by the other bird, touching and even preening the bird's feathers. Now, when the fights were more violent, well, the aggressor stayed away. But this time, it was the victim that sought comfort in another. The hurt bird would find another bird that wasn't involved in the fight. It would sit close to it and seek some consolation. This kind of reconciliation has rarely been observed in crows before. In fact, among animals, it has predominantly been studied in primates. But this study shows that the scavengers, like humans, are complicated creatures. They have tempers and are prone to fighting, but they're also highly social animals that depend on the herd for survival. So in this way, conflicts can be really costly. But a little bit of love and affection between the birds can help mend those wounds. This week I learned that the Vatican paints its walls with milk. It's a technique that dates back to cave drawings. Tens of thousands of years ago, some of Earth's oldest surfaces were decorated with a simple concoction of milk, lime, and earth pigments. Even the belongings of King Tutankhamun were found to be painted with milk paint. And even though some oil-based paints emerged as early as the 1400s, milk paint was still the preferred paint solution up through the Civil War, both because of the accessibility of milk, pretty much everyone had a goat or a cow, and because of its velvety, rich colors. It wasn't until 1868 when the first patent for that classic metal paint can with a tightly fitted top came in that the paint industry evolved into one for the masses. Now, mass-produced paint did not lend itself to milk since, like the kind you drink, milk paint can spoil. The Vatican began using milk paint in 1484 when the Vatican's Belvedere Palace, which is now a museum that houses precious artworks, was built. Back then, Vatican workers used essentially the same recipe as the cavemen did, mixing the milk byproduct with slaked lime and earth pigments if they're using any. The solution was then hand-patted onto the walls. Now, milk paint also fits in nicely with the Pope's mission of sustainability. Milk paint is a non-invasive method both for the environment and for people. And you might be tickled to know the milk the Vatican sources is from its own cows. Because, of course, the Vatican has its own cows for its organic milk paint. This week I learned about the time all of Iceland's women went on strike. know, Iceland has long been ahead of the curve when it came to women's rights. Women in Iceland, for example, got the right to vote in 1915, ahead of America, Canada, and the United Kingdom. But by 1975, that curve had kind of slipped. In the 60 years since suffrage, only 9 women had ever won seats in parliament there. And by 1975, just 5% of parliament was women, which was drastically less than other Nordic countries. So around the 1970s, a radical women's movement called the Red Stockings floated the idea that women should strike. But many women found the organization and the idea a little too confrontational. But over the next few years, the idea was massaged to be more inclusive, recognizing the work of housewives as much as politicians, while also covering women from all socio and economic backgrounds. When the strike was named Women's Day Off, it secured near universal support, including the backing by unions. So it was arranged. It was advertised, and on October 24th, 1975, 90% of the women of Iceland went on strike.
Við spyrjum okkur hver okkar daglegi þáttur innan þessara umgjörðar.
They refused to work or cook or even provide childcare. Banks, factories, schools, nurseries, and some shops had to close. Men were left to take care of their children, which meant a lot of them had to bring their kids to work. According to the BBC, you could actually hear children playing in the background while reporters were reading the news on the radio. Even in the most remote areas, when reporters called homes to gauge how many women were on strike, the phone was often answered by husbands who had been left to take care of the kids at home. Naturally, the next day, women returned to work, and by the looks of it, things had returned to normal. But this was absolutely a watershed moment for the country. 5 years after the event, a divorced single mother by the name of Vigdis Finnbogadottir beat out 3 men to become Iceland's president, the first woman in the world to be democratically elected as head of state. And Vigdis wasn't just a flash in the pan. She was so popular that she was re-elected, unopposed, in 2 of the next 3 elections. In 1983, a new political party, the Women's Alliance, won a seat in parliament. In the year 2000, paid paternity leave was introduced for men. And in 2010, the country welcomed its first female prime minister. When the workplace gender gap persisted, women took to the streets again in 2016. The strike wasn't quite as widespread, but it was very clever. Because women in Iceland were making 14% less than men, women decided to work 14% less of their day, leaving their offices and jobs at 2:38 on the dot in protest. In 2017, Iceland passed a law requiring all public and private companies with more than 25 employees to pay their workers equally, regardless of gender, ethnicity, sexuality, or nationality. Those companies would have to provide proof. And the aim is to close that gender gap by the year 2022. This week I learned that mountain climbing can literally drive you mad. I mean, I've always thought you had to be a little bit mad to want to ascend 30,000 feet in the air just for the thrill of it, but now science has confirmed that climbing mountains can cause temporary psychosis. There are actually several documented cases of mountaineers experiencing psychotic episodes at extreme altitudes. Climbers have been known to see movement or hear voices or music when there was none. Others have even claimed to feel the presence of another person climbing along with them, something referred to as the third man factor because it's so widespread. And often these episodes occur in people that are totally otherwise healthy. Now, for a long time, these hallucinations have been chalked up to just another side effect of altitude sickness. Altitude sickness can happen when a person ascends too fast for the body to become accustomed to the higher altitude's lower oxygen levels. You can feel really nauseous, get a headache, and much worse. But researchers out of Italy and Austria now believe the hallucinations are a separate condition, one they're calling high-altitude psychosis. Researchers combed 83 reports of mountain-based psychotic episodes, and then they analyzed the symptoms. And they found the symptoms could not be attributed to fluid loss, infections, diseases, or the effects of lower oxygen levels. Now, frankly, we are not sure why the psychosis occurs. It could have to do with a temporary swelling of the brain due to extreme conditions. It could also be brought on by the solitude or the intense pressure of this crazy event. But the good news is that once the person is back at a safe altitude, the symptoms of psychosis disappear and there are no lasting side effects. And that does it for this episode of This Week I Learned. To read more about any of the facts I've mentioned, you can head on over to theweek.com/podcasts, where you'll also find our full archive and our 7-Minute Opinions and 7-Minute Explainer series. This Week I Learned can also be found on Apple Podcasts or, frankly, wherever you listen. I'm Lauren Hansen, and thank you so much for listening.